Welcome back, everyone, to Jubilee Street, a music podcast. I'm Ian McCurtis. I am a music commenter from another dimension. Joined with Jake Curtis, joined with Blue the intern dog, Buffy the HR dog. And today we're talking about Mercy by Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds.
There was a podcast named Jubilee Street, a music podcast hosted by Jake and Ian. By the time this Jubilee Street podcast is over, negative information, okay?
I don't even need to put the song under the intro. You were nailing it. You were in key and everything.
I've listened to this song like 10 times in a row. I love this song. I had it memorized, ready to do the intro. I was planning it out. We did a warm-up for an hour. Ian told me about all these quiches that he's been making to prepare for Thanksgiving. He's been reading about Elon Musk a lot. He is avidly on Twitter after Elon bought the company. He's a big supporter. He's wearing his I Love Elon t-shirt.
I split my time between Twitter and Parler. Let's be fair.
Let's be fair. And by Parler, you mean like an old-timey like
yeah,
Parler.
Yeah, ice cream
like
Parler, you, like a, where I hang out.
Yeah. Go get fresh soft serve ice cream.
In a small town Indiana ice cream parlor.
Well, Ian, I'm very excited to be here with you. We've been off for a couple of weeks. And as soon as I put this song on, I was immediately hooked, and I once again am solidifying that in the future, if we do a draft, I think Tender Prey is going to be one of my first Nick Cave drafts. I think it's just so many great songs, and I think sequencing-wise, like coming right into this from watching Alice is just amazing. Context-wise, for anyone who might be, this might be their first episode, this is Tender Prey, and what year did it come out? I have it on my phone. I'm blanking on it.
I'm 88?
88 sounds right.
89?
To all the people screaming at us while we're talking here. Yes, it is 1988. We got our facts straight here on Jubilee Street. And Mercy is the fifth track from that record. Did you say all this in the intro and I'm just repeating it?
You went into more detail. Something that like a stupid moment on my part that I've never noticed in all my time of listening to this album is there's a song called Mercy Seat. And then also a song called Mercy. And I don't know how I've listened to this album tons of times and I've never like realized that.
Well, let's talk about that later because I wanted to ask you if you think there's any, I'm sure there is significance lyrically, but the one thing that we always like to mention, we always got to shout out our guy, Kid Congo Powers is on this track. He's doing backing vocals and guitar. Did you hear the saxophone on this song, or is it just a very low harmonica?
I definitely heard what I thought is harmonica, but maybe it's saxophone. I know the thing you're talking about, I think.
There's nothing on the track listing or personnel that show that it's saxophone, so I think it's a harmonica. And it also, again, just solidifies how solid the... I've been using the word solidify a lot in my life recently, and I feel like I'm going to use it a lot today, so I apologize to the listeners. Easy drinking game, though. Every time Jake says solid or solidify, which you already have four drinks going, take a drink.
I'll switch it up with another state of matter, and I'll say gas a lot today.
Yes, gas, because you have been eating a lot of Brazilian steakhouse.
I've been eating a lot of solid steaks that are turning into gaseous gas.
Yeah, so I just wanted the harmonica work on this record in general is really good. I feel like there's like a lot of emotive power behind that instrument. I feel like I kind of appreciate Neil Young a lot more after listening to these songs because Neil Young uses the harmonica so much in his work. Bob Dylan. So, yeah, what are your takeaways? I feel like I've said a lot already about it so far. I'll pass the mic over to you.
I kept thinking about you. Because you love to bring up the druggy years, and I feel like a lot of times you hear maybe drug influences or rehab, like a lot of times I think your mind goes there with this era of Nick Cave songs. And a lot of times that's not the first thing that pops in my mind. But I think out of all the songs we've ever done on this podcast, this is the one that sounds the most like drug addict trying to be clean song ever. There's so much like desperate. It just sounds like someone just like begging on their knees, either like, God, help me stop doing heroin, or God, please give me more heroin.
Well, so I think a sister song to this is Tupelo, because most of these early era Bad Seeds tracks are kind of moods. Like From Her to Eternity, I think, has a lot of mood tracks on it. And I think a lot about how the vibe of the music changes from the intro into the verse, where it goes, you know, like I was doing in the beginning of our podcast here, like, like kind of Jaws, like suspense is building, kind of makes you picture like somebody walking down an alley trying to score, or somebody who's like, you know, they're doing the routine, like putting the thing around their arm and, you know, pulling the band and finding the blood vessel, plunging. Well, you know, they're on a little album called Planet Waves with Bob Dylan. That's how I learned about them.
Oh my God.
I think even the language used in the first verse is just so, it's so akin to like, did you see the Roadrunner documentary about Anthony Bourdain?
No, you just reminded me that I need to watch it.
Okay, so it's really good. And without spoiling a lot of it for you, David Chang shows up in it, and he talks about how Anthony Bourdain told him about this. His favorite song was a Brian Jonestown Massacre song. And in this way that David Chang is almost like overly dramatically dramatic.
Yes, I know.
He talked about, like, you know, he was like, you know, when Tony told me that, and this isn't verbatim, he was like, this is, I was like, I go to him and I say, this is heroin music. And like, this isn't heroin, like Bad Seeds music. Heroin music, I don't believe, is what the Bad Seeds set out to make. I think they make music about falling from grace, which is why I think they love Elvis so much, or why Nick loves Elvis so much. Well, and that's what that first verse said. It said to me is, I stood in the water in the middle month of winter. My camel skin was torture. I was in a state of nature. This song, like, these are some of the best lyrics on this album. Like, and I cried mercy, have mercy upon me. This is a, you know, we always bring up religion on this podcast because Nick loves that shit. They love that shit in their lyrics. Like, but this is just the next level, like depression, angst, pain, like just full pain in this song, even though it goes hard in those choruses, like mercy on me. Like, could you imagine a punk cover of this song? It would be fucking awesome.
Yeah, I don't think this is the saddest Bad Seed song, but painful is the perfect word. There's so much just pain. Like, this is just a dude going through it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, this is like how I feel like we thought we felt in our 20s when we were depressed.
Well, that would have been the age, you know, Nick was making this, probably mid 20s. So, yeah. For sure.
Yeah. Fascinating track. And I think, like, seeing as how I think we may have, like, one more Tender Prey song we're going to cover before we get into our Christmas stuff. You know, definitely, like, kind of an apt choice because we're recording right before Thanksgiving. And I think more so now than ever, it's kind of a divided holiday. And I think a lot of, like, I choose to see it as, you know, a reason to gather with family, but like historically and culturally it's a genocidal holiday. And, you know, I just think there's a lot of parallels in like the sort of like abattoir blues quality of Thanksgiving. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Did you read into any to this the John the Baptist stuff with the song?
You know, I didn't. I didn't read too deep into it. I stayed very like personal, interpretive. Tell me about it.
So the song is like directly comparing, Nick is comparing himself to John the Baptist, and Most Nick Cave thing
ever.
No surprise to anyone. I used to know a lot more of my Bible stories when I was younger than I do now. I tried to refresh myself a little bit, but here's a short version. So John the Baptist, I believe there was a king who divorced his wife and married his brother's ex-wife, I want to say, or his brother's current wife. Mm-hmm. Some sort of like incestuous Bible time stuff. And
man, I love the Bible. So kinky.
John the Baptist was like, that's pretty fucked up, dude. You shouldn't marry your brother's wife. It's not cool. And the king didn't like that. Threw him in jail. And John the Baptist was then beheaded at the request of the woman's daughter. She said, kill that dude. And that's how John the Baptist was beheaded. Famous Caravaggio painting of John the Baptist's head on a platter.
Nice Caravaggio reference.
Yeah, you know my art history days. He was the master of chiaroscuro. No big deal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For anyone who's listening, Ian's flexing his bicep right now. art history bicep.
So I know that art history part to be true. I might have gotten the Bible story a little bit wrong, but basically this guy went against the king and was beheaded. I think also the government, if we go into like actual history, not in the Bible, I think the government didn't like how much power John the Baptist had. People liked him. People listened to him. I think maybe it might have just been the political move to assassinate him. Man. But yeah, so Nick Cave, this seems like a very like heroin addict thing to do. Like, you know, in your mental anguish, you like think of yourself as like Jesus. Like, this is something drug addicts do all the time, is like think of themselves in that way. So him comparing himself to John the Baptist is, you know, it hits home with people going through that, being in that state.
It says here that John was described as wearing clothes of camel's hair, which would reference the lyrics, and he lived on locusts and wild honey in the Gospel of Mark, according to Mark.
Not the worst diet. I mean, you got protein in the locusts, and you got some sugar, you got some energy in the honey. I mean, it'd be worse things to live on, I guess.
I kind of feel like wild honey, if you're like living in those times, it's probably the best possible food you could eat that isn't like potatoes or something, right?
My breakfast as of late, Jake, has been some nice multigrain bread, one slice of bread,
mm-hmm. Okay.
Thick layer of peanut butter on there.
Oh, peanut butter. Ooh, and then, I know what you're about to say afterwards.
And then a little drizzle of honey on top.
Now, can I ask you, do you like putting a couple pieces of the honeycomb on there?
No, I never like, there's something about the honeycomb. I don't love it. I want to, because isn't that supposed to be like where a lot of the like best vitamins
are? I'm telling you, take my advice here. It feels really gross,
yeah.
But get some of that local honey. Get some honey with the honeycomb in there.
Mm-hmm.
Make your bread. And then do your honey drizzle, and then take one little piece why am I forgetting it, what it's called again? What's it called?
Honeycomb?
The honeycomb. Take a little piece of the honeycomb and put that on there. I'm telling you, it's one of the, I don't eat honey anymore because I'm vegan, but I think that as far as foods go, like honeycomb is one of the most delicious things I've ever eaten. It's just so good.
That's a hotly debated topic, right? Whether or not honey is vegan.
Yeah, yeah. I think
it's like
not.
I'm known vegans that do eat some it, people, and then I'm known vegans that don't.
I'm one of the people that don't. I choose not to take anything from the animal, but there are people who are vegan who eat honey, and you know, it's whatever you want to do.
I mean, now you can get agave nectar anywhere. I mean, that's almost as good if you get some good agave nectar.
Sheesh, and just use a little maple syrup instead.
Oh yeah, maple syrup too. I found out at the Native American restaurant I went to in D.C., they didn't have sugar in a lot of, you know, sugar came from, I don't know where sugar came from. So a lot of Native Americans would use maple syrup to sweeten everything. So anything that would have sugar had maple syrup instead, which is great with me. I love the flavor of maple.
I love maple syrup, yeah.
So I had like an apple and like arugula salad that had like a little like basil maple syrup drizzle. So good.
Man, were there some like pecans or walnuts on there or something?
Some sort of nuts, yeah.
Yeah, you got to have like a little, like a nice fatty nut on there. So John the Baptist, we're talking about how he ate locusts and honey.
And got beheaded.
So the first thing, I Googled it while you were telling that story. It's really interesting. So he's also called the Immerser, and John the Baptizer. So I guess he is associated as some kind of disciple of God. Is that right?
Yeah. So from what I understand, the Bible makes it out that his death was due to him speaking out against the king, wherever the ruler was, emperor or whatever. I think history looks at it as more of like a political move because the king didn't like how powerful he was.
And it says here the Gospels betray John as the precursor or forerunner to Jesus.
Yeah, isn't John the Baptist Jesus' cousin? I really don't know a lot of the shit anymore.
I don't either, yeah. But I think it makes for great lyrical content for the Bad Seeds.
For sure, and it just like it all lines up. Well, I mean, what's more dramatic than the Bible? So, I mean, obviously this is something Nick Cave pulls from time and time again. We say it every episode.
Sorry, I'm just reading through the lyrics. We can edit this out. Well, what else comes to mind for you on this song? Anything musically you want to talk about?
The thing, it's that beginning that you already mentioned, the jaw. I thought the same thing, the Jaws thing. I think it's just moving in half step increments, major, minor, just setting that. I don't know, you almost think with this song being like pleading, it would feel welcoming, like I'm asking you, God, and there's this menacing feel of the music that just makes it so much more sinister. And I picture Nick in a church just like strung out, just like on his knees, just like, please, God.
I don't know why this is coming to me while you're saying that, but I immediately pictured the 1977 Suspiria. And do you remember when I think the girl gets like pushed through the glass? Is that am I remembering that correctly?
Towards the end?
No, it's in the beginning.
So she's in
that very bright color palette like building, and she kind of it's before Susie gets introduced, the main character. And then it's just that intro where you kind of get a feeling that there's something not quite right. I don't know. Suspiria, I'm watching the remake. I started it yesterday. I'm going to watch a little more after the podcast tonight. And it's just on my mind with this song because there's a very much like penitent and kind of punishing nature to that movie as far as like how they treat the dancers. And man, there's a lot of self-punishment going on in this song, right? Like, you have to wonder, he says, faith is my only weapon to rest the devil's legion. A speak hole would slide open, a viper's voice would plead. Thick with innuendo, syphilis, and greed. Some good rhymes going on there, but like, if we're to take this as analog to some kind of drug trip, it's almost as if our narrator is so, like, believes so little in his own power that's why he's having this delusion, is he is like, I am not powerful enough to save myself from this addiction, so I'll pretend that I'm this powerful person and still be high while I'm doing it, but effectively like not solving a problem in both ways, you know? Does that make sense?
The dude who directed the Suspiria remake is the guy who did Call Me By Your Name, right?
And he's doing that new cannibal movie. Luca Guadagnino.
The Guadagnino, yeah. So that's a great, it's an apt comparison because that dude would make a great short film out of this song. I was thinking, when you were talking about Suspiria, I was thinking about Call Me By Your Name, and it's the same themes, right? It's like self-hatred, but lust. You know, this guy is like gay, but he hate, you know, not comfortable with it, and self-loathing, and it's the same thing with Nick in the song. He doing drugs makes him feel good, but he hates himself for it. It's that same, those same themes.
Yeah, I think that there was a lot of that kind
shame, and guilt, and all that stuff.
Well, and I think that's why and I cried mercy, have mercy upon me is so effective in those repeated choruses because
like I can't help myself, it's who I am.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it reminds me a lot of, you know, what you hear about and, you know, like in sort of like support groups for like 12-step programs, like a lot of the stuff in those books is you're like, you have to give up yourself to a higher power. You're powerless to your addiction. And it made me think of that kind of stuff too, which the idea of it at first doesn't really make sense to you, but as you, I feel like as you go through those steps, you probably start to feel like it's not about God. It's about this other thing. It's an interesting concept.
Yeah, I think it's so counterintuitive to how I think, because, I mean, both of us, we're not religious or anything. So it's like, whenever I hear about those 12-step programs, I'm like, this is bullshit. But I guess it's not really, because I feel like the way me and you care about art and TV and movies, it's the same thing. It's something, you know, I believe in storytelling is like this thing bigger than people. You just need to have something that like feels like it's worth living for. So if it's God, it's God, whatever you want to call it.
What do you make of the line, my death, it almost bored me, so often was it told?
You have the lyrics pulled up?
Yeah.
Is bored so like B-O-A-R, or is it B-O-R?
Like bored, like I'm bored watching this Spider-Man movie.
My death, it almost bored me. What's after that?
My death, it almost bored me, so often was it told, and I cried mercy on me.
So I heard it as bored, like B-O-A-R, like getting like impaled. Like,
I mean, that's a cool way to hear it, I think. So it's the same. It's the same verse that he says, my cousin was working miracles. I wondered if he'd find me. The moon was turned toward me like a platter made of gold. And then my death, it almost bored me.
So that's the Jesus stuff. Jesus being John the Baptist's cousin.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Jesus is out there working miracles.
That's sort of the devil is in those details there, right? Like, you start to lose yourself when you start comparing yourself to people, and he's almost like comparing himself to Jesus as far as like, I'm over here getting beheaded. My story sucks. Jesus got to work all these miracles. Fuck that guy.
It reminds me of that, the Roland S. Howard song we did, Shivers, where in the first line, like, I would try suicide, but it's not my style.
Oh, that's such a good line.
That's sort of the my death had bored me. And isn't there a Smith song where Morrissey says something like, I would kill myself, but I think I'll just fall asleep or something like that?
Yeah, that sounds.
What the line
that,
is.
I mean, that sounds like any pretty much every song he wrote.
Any Morrissey song? Yeah.
Mercy on me.
I was trying to find the Smith's lyric, but I can't think of it.
Mercy on me. What's your favorite song on Tender Prey? Let's narrow it down. So we've done The Mercy Seat, Up Jump the Devil, Deanna, Watching Alice, Mercy, and New Morning. So we have City of Refuge, Slowly Goes the Night, Sunday Slave, and Sugar, Sugar, Sugar Left. So of the six we've covered, what are your favorites?
So I know my three favorites on the album are Mercy Seat, Up Jump the Devil, Watching Alice.
Okay.
Narrowing down from those three, are those would you say those are your three favorites?
Mercy Seat, Mercy, Up Jump the Devil.
Okay.
Maybe switch out Up Jump the Devil for Watching Alice, but I feel like Mercy kind of fulfills that slower song role or slot.
And then I guess I'll narrow it down between tracks one and two, Mercy Seat and Up Jump the Devil. Those are both like such iconic Nick Cave songs to me. I don't know. It's hard to not give it to the Mercy Seat. Like, it's like that is like the Nick Cave song. You know?
If someone was trying to get into Nick Cave and they were like, I bought this Tender Prey album. I'm going to listen to it when I get home. Which, like, I guess let's reframe it.
Umpt Up the Devil, I think, is a better one that's like indicative of his other stuff.
So you would, if they were like, I want to get into this era of Nick Cave, which song? You would say Up Jump the Devil?
I feel like if someone listened to Up Jump the Devil and didn't like it, they're probably not going to like anything from this era in Nick Cave.
I would say that's fair.
I feel like it's pretty, like, it encapsulates a lot of things that Nick Cave does.
Okay. All right.
Mercy Seat's a more, like, unique song.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not a lot of songs sound like the Mercy Seat. What hits you, and maybe it'll be hard to remember if you haven't listened to Mercy Seat in a long time, like, what hits you is more emotional, the Mercy Seat about someone about to die, or this song about just, like, pleading to God for, like, help?
I thought I had the lyrics pulled up. Let me pull up the lyrics, and I'll revisit it. I mean, I think Mercy Seat is
Mercy
the
Seat's
more
like, it's like, I'm not, like, you know, in that song he says, I'm not afraid to die. Mercy is a song of someone who's afraid.
It began when they took me from my home and put me in Dead Row, of which I am nearly wholly innocent, you know, and I'll say it again, I am not afraid to die. It's probably recency bias, but I feel like there is a sadder quality to Mercy because it's sort of more in like a love song kind of tone, if that makes sense. Like, it feels a lot more sad. Mercy Seat is kind of, there's like a dissonance to it. It's kind of scary, but it's ultimately kind of cathartic because if you are like, most people don't have the opportunity might be the wrong word to use. Most people don't have like a chance to know when death is coming. I think that's why the death penalty is so fucked up. And I think that the one courtesy that we as humans can do to each other is not like not take that away. Like, the randomness of death is kind of what makes it easier to like prepare for, because like if you get into a car accident, I feel like it's like the whole thing with The Sopranos, right? Like, in the second half of season 6, they talk about like Bobby Bacalieri's on his boat with Tony, and he's like, you know, do you think you hear it when it happens? And they're referring to like, when you get shot, do you hear it before you die? Like, do you hear the gunshot before you die? And just complete, you know, you just flatline. So that's kind of what I think of. There's like kind of a calming quality to the Mercy Seat because it is sort of desperate and pleading, but not in the way that Mercy is. And I think it's interesting that they did the Mercy Seat as the first track, and then the halfway point is Mercy.
So Mercy Seat, you're right. You don't, it's not relatable in the same way. You know, most people are not ever going to get the death penalty. I think the Mercy Seat's a better song. I think you'd probably agree. But Mercy, plain Mercy, this song is, anyone who's ever, I don't want to get too into your personal life, but I feel like you went through this recently. Anyone who's ever like just sat there at night being like, I don't fucking know what to do next with my life. Like that feeling, which we've all had at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're just like, I don't know what to do next. This song is that feeling.
Well, and it's interesting juxtaposed with the Mercy Seat, because the idea of the Mercy Seat, it's an interesting wording, because it's like, if you sit here, you will get mercy. Like, God have mercy on your soul. But then
you get to have an end.
It's almost more interesting, like, what words follow? Like, what if that person was a mass serial killer? What if they were a pedophile? What if they were both? What if they were a rapist? Like, you're going to say, you know, there's going to be...
That's what makes that line so genius, where, what's he say? It's a crime that I'm almost wholly innocent from.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's interesting. The death penalty is almost too merciful in some ways in that regard, because you're ridding the world of this terrible person who did these terrible acts, but they may have been tortured in a way, whereas it's kind of perverse the way that the story is being told on Mercy, because it feels very privileged and entitled. Like, the way he talks about his cousin Jesus.
My cousin Jesus.
How he's bored by his life. He's like bored. Like, asking for like death when you're bored is like just completely offensive. You know, the Mercy Seat is snide and sneering, and kind of like, you can see this like rascal sitting in the chair, and there's definitely people in the crowd who are like, fuck this guy. And he's just like, I got away with it. Fuck you. I'm dead. You know, like, he doesn't care about getting mercy. He's not afraid. He's faced that, you know, whether he is as despicable or not, as the song alludes to.
It reminds me a lot of Kurt Cobain, what you're saying. I feel like Nirvana has a lot of songs that oscillate between like extreme emotions and then complete apathy. And that's sort of how this song is. Like, the chorus is very emotional, but then there's parts in the verses where he's like, actually, I don't really fucking care.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, this was right before the 90s. That's a very 90s sentiment, is like,
yeah, I guess, you know, 90s rock is very apathetic. It's just like, who
it's like, oh, I feel so much, but who, I'm just fucking kidding, you know?
Well, let's go smoke some weed, yeah.
I'll just go, you know, shoot up or whatever, like, and then I'll go see the breeders open for Smashing Pumpkins or something. Like, that's the kind of shit that was going on.
I guess, yeah, that's grunge in a nutshell, for sure. I'm really mad, but I don't care.
That's a really good question, and it definitely has made me appreciate both of those songs a lot more because, you know, to kind of full circle it, I was thinking the same thing when you picked this. I was like, oh, wait, it never occurred to me that there are two songs with the word mercy on this album. The album's called Tender Prey, which is an interesting title because tender would lead you to, like, the thing that you want to hear after tender is love, or if you're cooking, meat, right? So
tender, isn't tender mercy a phrase?
Tender mercy is a phrase, but they're like, tender is, it's always like, you know, you got a cut and you're, you know, you haven't scabbed over yet, so the wound is tender.
TLC, tender love and care.
Yes, that's perfect segue. Like, love is
chicken tender.
Love is tender. Like, you know, it's, you know, you want to tenderly make love to your partner. It's, there's something, it's like soft, but then you have the word prey afterwards. So they're basically setting off from the start of this album, like, their pitch for Tender Prey is like, this is going to, we're going to kill you softly. Like, this album is going to decimate you, and we're going to tenderize you and then put you in the mercy seat. If I can be so bold to interpret it that way. So you're going to be begging for mercy after this, after you hear this record.
People will be begging for this episode, begging for mercy from this episode by the time it's over.
By the time this Jubilee Street podcast is over, you're going to be begging for mercy, okay?
That sounds like a horror movie trailer. Like, you'll be begging for mercy by the time this movie's over.
There's definitely going to be a character in that horror movie, like, in the trailer, that's like, me and my cousin Jesus are going to be begging for mercy after this.
Just wait till I tell my cousin Jesus about you.
I'm going to tell my cousin Jesus about this.
Can make a great Nick Cave movie with all the different characters.
Well, it's just the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. They do it, but Jesus isn't it. Jesus, get in here and bring Grandpa. Feed him his blood.
So it'd be like the Bethlehem Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, and then it would, I feel like that's almost so close to being a porno title. Like the Bethlehem.
Oh, for sure. I think most people who see that think, well, either think it's a religious movie or pornographic film. Is
the Bethlehem Deep Penetration Massacre. The Bethlehem Chainsaw Dildo. Like, it's just a chainsaw of dildos. Oh, man.
Dude, I went to the movies last week, and apparently they put out, there's some, like, new religious movie about Jesus.
Oh, yeah?
And there were so many Christians there to see it.
Did you see Tar? Is that what you were going to see?
No, I saw Black. I really want to see Tar. I guess it'll be on streaming soon. It's already out of theaters in Louisville.
I heard a lot of good things about it.
I've heard it's a movie of the year, so I'm excited to see it. I'm hoping to see The Menu this weekend.
I want to see that other one about the people on the ship with Woody Harrelson. I've heard that movie's fucking awesome.
I don't know about that. This is the time of year where they put out all the Oscar bait movies.
Yep.
And that Harvey Weinstein movie just came out that looks good.
Ooh, Harvey Weinstein? Is somebody playing him in the movie?
It's called She Said. It's about the journalist who, like, broke the Harvey Weinstein story.
That's awesome. That sounds like a good movie.
It's like a drama. Sounds like an Aaron Sorkin movie, but I don't think it's Aaron Sorkin.
Before I ask you my next question, anything else you want to cover about Mercy Seat before we move into our next segment?
There's one thing before we get to our live music corners.
Okay.
When I brought up Kurt Cobain, it reminded me of this. Have you ever heard of a band called Os Mutantes?
Of course. Yeah, great band.
You have?
Yeah, they're like a Brazilian kind of freak-out band.
Yeah, so I never heard of them. And I just saw this random comment on Reddit where someone was like, I think Os Mutantes is better than the Beatles. And I was like, what?
They're really, band. Really good band. I've only heard like one record, I think.
And they started in like the mid-60s, and they sound just like the Beatles. But I was like, who, you know, I never heard of them in my whole life. I was like, who knew? And then I'm reading about them, and Kurt Cobain offered them like a lot of money to play a reunion show in like 1993.
Awesome.
And I'm constantly finding these like obscure bands, at least to America, that Kurt Cobain knew about. And he lived in a time before the internet. And I'm just like, how did he know all this shit?
dude.
And he's like early 20s.
I'm telling you, like, there.
How did 23-year-old Kurt Cobain know about Os Mutantes?
I mean, okay, so think about it. The way that we have music now, just remove the internet. So people who loved music were making magazines and zines. That's how it happened. Yeah, he probably just got subscriptions to, like, you know, whatever label was putting out Brazilian music. And you know what I mean? Like, he just, I feel like back then all you could do was follow the labels. So he probably, I mean, I think it makes total sense that he would find that. And he probably, also, how much time, if you spend enough time in a record store, given any era, like, they're getting sent records that, like, no one else is going to, like, buy, that just sit there, and then somebody picks them up 10 years later. And lo and behold, the band's been big for like 10 years.
It's just cool the amount of knowledge people were able to have about music before the internet, you know?
It's really cool. That's a cool story.
If the thirst is there, you will find it.
Mm-hmm. As,
something like that.
As Babs Bunny likes to say in Tiny Toons, if you build it, they will come.
Paul Dini's greatest work.
So I have, before we get into our live music corner, I think we should do a new segment called Ian's Slice of Life, where you talk about, like, movies that you went to see or food that you ate that you liked.
Shout out Ben's Chili Bowl in Washington, D.C. Legendary chili dog restaurant.
You want me to make a little jingle for him?
Before? I got a spicy half smoke. Yeah, make a Ben's Chili Bowl scene.
Spicy half smoke. Come on in to Bill's Chili Bowl.
Ben's.
Oh, wait. Spicy half smoke. Ben's Chili Bowl. There you go.
They'll love it. Movies. Shout out the first two-thirds of Black Panther 2.
Okay.
Maybe the best Marvel movie until the final act, like all of them. That kind of sucks.
Spoiler territory. You want to talk any spoilers?
It's just it's a cool thing they do with, like, colonialization. They make Namor like a
colonizer?
South American. No, like, his people also got colonized, and so it's two nations. It's Namor's nation and Wakanda. Both don't want to, like, enter the rest of the world. They want to stay closed off, and Namor wants to team up with Wakanda, but Wakanda doesn't want to. It's just a really interesting, like, political movie. And they got dude from the West Wing in it. They got Julia Louis-Dreyfus for the little Veep connection. Like, it's very political and interesting. And then it's just, like, a huge CGI fest at the end.
Can I ask, this is, like, the last movie in the Marvel sequence, right? For this year? What do they call it?
Oh, for this phase?
Phase.
I think the Ant-Man movie in, like, February or March is the last one in this phase.
So what did they set up? Because I figured this was going to be a big reveal Marvel movie because it was so hyped.
Nah, this movie was all about just, like, celebrating Chadwick Boseman.
Hmm, okay.
And then Wakanda's relationship with the rest of with Namor and with it didn't really, it was very self-contained to Wakanda.
So there was no, like, after-credit sequence?
There was one, but it didn't set up anything outside of Black Panther.
That seems pretty much on par with, I think, like,
It was a pretty small, I mean, as small a movie can be with a huge fight scene, but it was, like, compared to other Marvel movies, pretty small.
Is there a lot of, like, water sequences, like with fish and stuff?
They do some really cool special, the people from Namor's Nation, I can't remember what it's called, they don't call it Atlantis, they give it a, like, South American Aztec name, I think?
Yeah.
They have these bombs, but they, like, plant them, and then it just explodes with water and, like, just destroys shit.
Oh, wow.
And it's really cool. I think it's a lot of practical effects. I saw the guy playing Namor trained himself to be able to hold his breath for, like, 4 minutes at a time.
That's crazy.
Underwater.
That's really crazy.
A lot of cool, like, practical effects with water. Angela Bassett was top-notch. She's such a good actress.
I heard that there's, like, she's trying to get the Oscar for that. Like, people think she might get an Oscar now.
So I was telling Courtney this. Tell me if you agree. You know when you watch movies from, like, the 50s, like a black and white movie?
Mm-hmm.
And there's this way people act that's, like, people in real life don't act like that. It's, like, real, like,
thespian.
Over the top. Thespian, yeah. Angela Bassett's like that. She's, like, an old school movie actress.
Yeah.
She would fit in 50 years ago.
Yeah. So she's just...
But she's still great now. She just seems like she comes from another time.
She's just a knockout as far as, like, those movies
go. She's an actor.
An actor. All right, we want to get into live music corner?
Yeah, hit me with it.
All right, so welcome everybody to another iteration of Jake and Ian's Live Music Corner. So Ian is, he stays going outside, basically, you know. I finally got out.
I don't leave my house. I don't go outside. I don't do shit.
I think the last concert I went to genuinely was Paul McCartney, and that was back in May. So I went to see a little old band from Japan called Melt Banana at the
Legendary. We covered them on the podcast. Check out the birthday party cover.
And I saw them at the legendary Kasbah venue in San Diego. I like the venue a lot. It's got this really cool, like when you come in and they check your ID and stuff, there's like a long corridor and then there's like kind of an outdoor area. Then there's a bar and then the band's kind of set up in the back. And then as before you head back to that outside bar area, you'll make an immediate right and then you come into another bar and then that's where the venue is. And there's like a long like slab of wood, like bar where you can like stand and watch and put your drinks down. And there's a pretty good little area. So I got there around, I think, 9. The show started around 8. I saw the first band, who were called Ed Schrader's Dead Music Beat. I think that's what it's called.
You just texted me the name of the band with no context.
Yeah. Let me check it. We can edit out this awkward silence.
It was something like that. You said the name of the two bands, and then you said a lot of dudes who look like Tyler.
Yeah. Okay, they're called Ed Schrader's Music Beat. I got their names mixed up. They were really cool. I would say it was kind of Nick Cave-y. Like, the lead singer was super energetic, had kind of a dramatic way of singing, a little bit of Talking Heads, David Byrne going on. Definitely, like, pretty, like they're called Music Beat. Like, it was, like, kind of a dance punk band, so they were really cool. And then after that, I was like, I can have one beer, kind of just relax. It was my Friday night. And I go to get a beer. I paid $8 for the beer. Such a fucking racket. But I wanted something to hold on to. I was kind of nervous. I hadn't been out. I was by myself. And a little old band called Def Club comes on. And I should have known based on the guys, because both guitar players had skullets. So I was just like, okay, this is either going to be like a punk band or it's going to be like a fucking grindcore band. There was no in between. Soon as they start playing, there's this guy who stood right in front of me. He was wearing one of these, like, I don't know how to describe it, but it looks like a jacket that like a hardcore kid would wear. And he stands right in front of me, fully shaved head. I'm pretty sure he either had a tattoo or a birthmark on his scalp. And I was like, okay, this guy's definitely going to push me at some point. But I stayed there. And then as soon as they start playing, crowd erupts. I'm caught in this mosh pit. I'm like standing there for a second. People keep running into me. I spill part of my beer. I'm like, fuck this shit. I don't want to be a part of this. So I moved to watch them. Turns out the lead singer was in The Locust. So this is his new band.
Aren't The Locust from that area?
I think so. I don't know off the top of my head. But Def Club was... Now that you know they're in The Locust, you know what it sounds like. Like, it was...
So it was like 30 seconds?
It wasn't quite 30 seconds, but they were really heavy. They were really fun to watch. There was one guitar player who, I don't know if you've seen the layout of the Kasbah, but they have like a whole area, like kind of around the back of the stage. And, you know, there's little pockets where you can put speakers, and he was like climbing up on things. I'm sure the sound guys hated him, but super energetic. The lead singer was kind of... I don't want to say cringe, but he didn't have, like, his banter didn't land with the audience a lot. Like, he was like, fuck Arizona. Mm-hmm. We just left Arizona. Fuck them. And, you know, it's like, okay, we get it. Arizona, you know, it's a red state, like, whatever. But they were a good band. They were super heavy. I hadn't really seen a band like that out in a long time. And then after them, I moved over to the far right, so stage left, and Melt Banana started, and it was one of the best live bands I've ever seen live. They played a lot from the album We Know, Fetch.
Did they play as a three-piece? How many people were there? Just two
and,
people, wow.
The woman, who I should know her name, I don't know her name, and the guy who played guitar. So the woman set up a laptop. They had two huge cabinet speakers, and then the guitar player had a head cabinet set up with a big pedal board, as you could imagine. And she had this like remote control, like it looked like a Wiimote kind of thing, but it was a MIDI pad. Mm-hmm. And she activated all the drums on there. So she would do this thing where she would like kind of like look like a sort of mad scientist and like kind of like move her arms around, and like then you would see her kind of like do this like, you know, movement with her arms to like activate the instruments, and it was super dramatic. And they sounded like they do recorded. It was crazy. And my favorite part of the set is they did a Devo cover. And it's the one that goes like na 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 na. That was fucking awesome. I'd say they probably played for about 45 minutes, and they did.
That's not very long. That's
funny that you say that. So they did a section of their set where all the songs were like 5 seconds.
NoFX does that sometimes. I love that.
And I can't state enough, like, if you, anyone listening, Ian, you got to catch them on tour. Like, they are, like, they didn't miss a beat. The guitar player was fucking awesome to watch. He was, like, shredding the whole time. He looked like Rick from Rick and Morty. Like, his hair was all, like,
oh, yeah.
He had, like, his hair out in this cool do. And it was cool because he was getting down and he was wearing a mask and he had taped it to his face. So I was like, you know, kudos for you for like keeping the mask on. And I guess he's, you know, obviously they're touring a lot. They don't want to get sick. Great show. I saw my friend Skylar from my Digimon Locals. So I talked to him for a little bit. And he's in a band called G Anon. They're like a industrial band. So it was cool to see him. We talked about Digimon for a little bit and then I went home. So it was a cool show.
Yeah, that's awesome. I got to see. So I don't know if I've ever seen a Japanese band. I got two. I have to see Melt Banana, and I got to see Envy, both living legends.
Yeah, I was thinking about bands that I want to see before either I get too old and I don't want to go to concerts, which will probably never happen, but I definitely have really, like, I don't know, it's just, Haley and I go to shows together sometimes, but I think I used to go to shows more when I had more friends around, and we've just become more isolated living out here, especially with the pandemic. But yeah, definitely catch them live. They were really good. And then I was thinking, if you can line it up, whenever you guys come to visit San Diego, we should see if there's a show at the Casbah so you can go see a band there.
Yeah, I'd love to either go there or Shea Cafe. I would love that.
Yeah, yeah. And then Belly Up is another good venue there that I think is connected with the Casbah. So that's another good venue. So you got some live music to share. Like I think it's Waxahachie.
So when I was in D.C., there's two legendary punk venues there I wanted to go to, the 930 Club and the Black Cat, but there weren't shows. Always was playing at one of them, but it sold out, so I wasn't able to go to either of those. I ended up seeing Planes at...
Trains?
Automobiles. I ended up seeing Planes at the freaking... Oh, what was the venue called? Was it called the Howard Theater? I'm sorry, everyone. Let me look this up.
They legalized weed in D.C., so Ian can't remember anything anymore.
Planes, Washington, D.C. Of course, that doesn't... Yeah, the Howard Theater. So that's what I thought. So it was right on Howard University, which was cool to be in that area. It's like a very famous, you know, almost like Harlem, like Black Culture Center. So the Howard Theater was really cool. It had been around for like 100 years. Apparently, Duke Ellington would play there like all the time, like... You know, for a week at a time.
Whoa.
All the jazz legends. That's where they all played. Like, all of them. That was, like, one of the few stops in the country that was, like, the center for jazz was this Howard Theater. And apparently, they pretty much had exclusively black music there until Martin Luther King was assassinated. There were riots. People didn't want to go to that part of town, from what I understand, so they had to start bringing in other genres of music so people would go there so they could make money. So now the place has all kinds of music. So I saw Planes, which is Waxahachie's new project. I think it's just a one-off thing. They put out an album and they're doing a tour. And then MJ Linderman opened. Have you heard of him?
No.
He's the guitar player in this band called Wednesday that's like really blown up this year. They're like the hot band in indie rock. He only plays guitar in that band. He also has a solo thing. The solo thing's also blown up. So
MJ Linderman. He's
juggling two things. Yeah. And what did Courtney say? I thought it sounded like Neil Young mixed with early Modest Mouse.
Oh,
you
speak.
You
would have
really liked it. Just kind of spacey, but really heartfelt.
Mm-hmm.
Little, they had a steel guitar player, so it was a little tinge of like country, but not really. More in the way Modest Mouse would use
it.
Stuff like that.
Yeah,
they were really good. They were really loud, just like a solid headbang, kind of slow. You know, southern rock almost.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw Plains, which is like Wax. It's Waxahachie and another woman. I think her name's Jess Williamson. They trade off songs. It's like full 90s country, like Shania Twain, Dixie Chicks kind of vibe. They had the outfits and the backdrop. And it was awesome. It was cool seeing, like, you know, I leave town to go to Washington, D.C. and go to a country concert, just something you would think I would do in Kentucky. It was just like a cool mixture of worlds.
That's awesome.
It was a great show.
Did you have a favorite part of the set, or was everybody great?
They closed with, I don't know if you know the song, Goodbye Earl by the Dixie Chicks.
I'm sure I know it, but you'd have to sing it for me.
They closed with that. And
that's
it was
awesome.
Really fun. Everyone in the crowd was singing. Nothing too exciting. They, you know, they weren't going crazy like Mel Bonanno was, I'm sure, but it was just a solid show. Waxahachie has one of my favorite voices ever. I could listen to her sing all day.
That was one crazy thing about Mel Bonanno is I hadn't been to a show with moshing like that in a long time.
Yeah, I got... Where did I? Oh, with the Me Without You show, I was in the mosh pit and I was like, I haven't done this in a couple of years since before COVID. I'm gonna feel like shit the next day, and luckily I was all right.
Yeah, I think it's more so about how hard you go. Like if you're kind of just like going in for a second, dancing, and then getting out. But the people at this show were like throwing fucking bows and shit. It was annoying.
Oh yeah, I don't like that. Yeah, I kind of just like being in with the people moshing, but like
yeah.
I can take all the hits. Like, yeah, I'm not really the one, like, dishing it out. I just kind of like being in the action.
Yeah, I did appreciate the security was pretty on top of it. So there was never, like, I definitely got bumped into a lot, but there was always a place where you could get where you weren't super in the action. I've never been. I try
to be mindful of that, especially, like, now that I'm older. Like, when I saw My Chemical Romance, like, if I go to a show and there's a lot of, like, young teenagers that aren't used to shows like that, I kind of try to be like the Good Samaritan. Like, I know how a mosh pit works. I can kind of be the guy that stands on the outside and like fends the people off and
yeah,
protect the youngins.
Yeah, you got to be the pit master. Any other shows you went to? You go to see a lot of music, so I wouldn't be surprised.
No, I wanted to see Always, but it sold out. I'm not going to. I'm seeing the Beach Boys in a few weeks. They're doing a Christmas concert at the Louisville Palace.
That's awesome.
The show I'm going to. Yeah, I'm stoked.
Are all the Beach Boys going to be there?
No, it's they only like all play for like big deal stuff. They don't. Brian Wilson doesn't tour anymore, so it's no Brian Wilson, which is a bummer. But it'll still be cool just to say I saw the Beach Boys.
That'll be really cool. Well, who is it? Is it one of the other?
I think the only original one that tours is Mike Love.
Oh wow.
So yeah, I know John Stamos used to tour with the Beach Boys. I don't think he is right now. He kind of
John Stamos. The actor?
Yeah.
Is he a musician?
Yeah, he loves the Beach Boys. Like, in Full House, he loved the Beach Boys. He actually loves the Beach Boys in real life.
Does he play in the band?
Yeah, like, he's kind of had a bit of a career resurgence, so he might be full-time acting now, but he used to tour with the Beach Boys.
That's really cool. What else has he acted in? I didn't know he had a career resurgence.
I don't know. I just feel like I see him in, like, commercials, and I feel like he had... It just seems like he's kind of relevant again now that, like, everything from the 90s is popular.
Yeah, that's true. Did you see they made a sequel to A Christmas Story?
Yeah, I did.
I heard it. I heard Haley watched it. She said it was great.
Oh, it's already out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure I'll watch it. I saw Will Ferrell was doing another Christmas movie, and it looks horrible. Like trying to make Elf again.
Oh, that sucks. I mean, Elf is such a classic. Why try if you
it's
can.
It's not a sequel. It's just another Christmas movie with
sure.
Will Ferrell in it.
Well, he did that other one, right? Like Daddy's Home or something?
Did he?
A couple years ago
that.
With Mark Wahlberg. I don't know if it was Christmas-themed, but I feel like one of them was Christmas-themed, yeah. That leads me to a cool topic maybe we can do for the podcast is top five Christmas movies. Christmas movie draft.
That's a good one.
Yeah. Well, Ian, I think I'm all good. You want to bring it home?
Yeah, thank you, everyone, for listening, as always. Thank you to Blue the Intern Dog. Thank you to Buffy the HR Dog. Blue needs to keep an eye on you, Jake. I'm going to be asking for updates.
Okay, why?
It's about to be Christmas time. If you get out of line, Blue will let me know. I'll let Santa know.
Okay, yeah. Well, that explains why she's been practicing how to write these letters C-O-O-A-L.
That's pretty good motor skills for a dog, really.
Well, she's holding the pen with two paws. It doesn't work very well.
The letter C, O, and L, you know, they're on the easy side. A is a tough letter for a dog to write.
Yeah, yeah, she's been struggling. I'll hear her in here, and she's like, A! A! And I'm like, you have to write it. You can't say it. She's learning.
She's learning. If you could leave us a rating, 5 stars, a review.
Apple Podcasts, really Spotify.
We will be back in a few days with something else, and then it'll be Christmas time after that, baby.
On our way from Stockholm. R.I.P.
Shout out low. Good night, everybody.